The man mumbled something, showing his ruined teeth. His face was also wrecked. I didn't know by what, being still too young to recognize the face of a drinker. He made a grimace that was exactly like one of Luigi Guglielmina's, and at that moment I realized how much he resembled him. My father began to gesture slowly. I understood that he was explaining something, and knowing him, knew also that his arguments would be unanswerable. The man lowered his gaze, just as I always did. It looked as if he was having second thoughts, but he kept hold of my father's shirt. My father turned up the palms of his hands, as if to say, "Okay, do we understand each other? So now what?" There was something ridiculous in seeing him in this situation barefoot. On his calves, the line made by his socks sharply divided his pale ankles from a narrow band of scarlet skin just below the knee, the area that his +4s left bare. Here was the educated city dweller, sure of himself and used to telling others what to do, who had just burned his legs on the glacier and was now trying to reason with a Highlander the worse for drink. The man decided that he'd had enough. Suddenly, and without warning, he lowered his right hand to make a fist and hit my father on the temple. It was the first time in my life that I had seen a real punch thrown. The sound of knuckle on cheekbone was clear even from the bathroom, dry as a whack with a stick. My father took 2 steps back, staggered, but managed not to fall. But immediately afterwards, his arms fell to his sides and his shoulders sagged a little. It was the posture of a wretched man. The other man said something else before leaving, a threat or a promise, and it did not surprise me to see him heading, in the end, towards the Guglielmina's house. During that brief confrontation, I had realized who he was. He had come back to reclaim what was his. He did not know that he had got the wrong person, but in the end it made no difference. That blow was thrown into my father's face in order to plant something clearly in the mind of my mother. It was the eruption of reality into her idealism, and perhaps also into her arrogance. The next day, Bruno and his father were nowhere to be seen. My father's left eye became swollen and blue, but I don't think that was what was hurting most when he got into his car that evening and left for Milan. The following week was our last in Grana. Bruno's aunt came to speak to my mother, mortified, wary, worried, perhaps above all by the prospect of losing such faithful tenants. My mother reassured her. She was already thinking about damage limitation, about how to salvage the relationships that had been so painstakingly nurtured. For me, it proved to be an interminable week. It rained constantly. A blanket of low-lying cloud cover hid the mountains from view, occasionally clearing to expose the first snow at 3,000 meters. I would like to have taken one of the paths I knew and gone up to tread all over it without asking permission from anyone. But I stayed in the village instead, replaying what I had seen and feeling guilty about what had happened. Then on Sunday, we locked the house and left as well. 4. I could not get that blow out of my mind until a few years later I found the courage to deliver one myself. In truth, it was the first of a series, and the hardest of these I would go on to land in the valley in later years. But now it seems right that my rebellion should have begun in the mountains, like everything else that has mattered to me. The event itself was unremarkable. I was 16, and one day my father decided to take me camping. He had bought an old heavy tent from a stall selling army surplus gear. He had this idea of putting it up on the side of a small lake, fishing for a few trout without being discovered by the forest rangers, lighting a fire at nightfall and roasting the fish on it, and afterwards, who knows, staying up late drinking and singing, warmed by its embers. He had never shown the slightest interest in camping, so I suspected that there was something else that had been planned for me. In recent times, I had withdrawn into a corner from which I observed our family life with a pitiless eye. The ineradicably fixed habits of my parents, my father's harmless outbursts of anger, and the tricks that my mother used to contain them. The little bullyings and the subterfuges that they no longer realized they were resorting to. He would be emotional, authoritarian, irascible. She would be strong and calm and conciliatory. They had a mutually reassuring way of always playing the same part, knowing that the other would play theirs. These were not real arguments. They were performances with always predictable endings. And in that cage, I also ended up being caught. I had begun to feel an urgent need to escape, but I had never managed to say so. Not once had I uttered a single protest about anything. And I think that it was precisely for this, to make me speak, that the damn tent had materialized. After lunch, my father spread out the equipment in the kitchen and divided it up so as to distribute its weight equally between us. The poles and pegs alone must have weighed 10 kilos. With the sleeping bags, anoraks, sweaters, and food supplies on top, the rucksacks soon became full. With one knee on the kitchen floor, my father began to loosen every strap and then to push, compress, pull, at war with mass and volume, and I could already feel myself sweating beneath that load in the sweltering afternoon heat. But it wasn't only the weight that was unbearable. It was the scene that he had conjured up, or that they had, the campfire, the lake, the trout, the starry sky, all that intimacy. "Dad," I said, "come on, that's enough." "Wait, wait," he said, still trying to stuff something inside the rucksack, absorbed by the effort. "No, I mean, it's no good." My father stopped what he was doing and looked up. He had a furious expression on his face from his exertions, and the way he looked at me made me feel like another hostile rucksack, another strap that wouldn't comply. I shrugged. With my father, if I kept quiet, it meant that he could speak. He unfurrowed his brow and said, "Well, perhaps we can take some stuff out. Lend a hand if you feel like it." "No," I replied. "I really don't feel like doing this." "What don't you feel like doing? The camping?" "The tent, the lake, the whole thing." "What do you mean, the whole thing?"
"I don't want it. I'm not coming."
I could not have dealt him a harder blow. Refusing to follow him into the mountains, it was inevitable that it would happen sooner or later. He must have expected it. But sometimes I think that because he had no father of his own, he had no experience of making certain kinds of attack, and was therefore ill-prepared to receive one. He was deeply hurt. Maybe he could have asked me a few more questions, and it would have been a good occasion to hear what I had to say. But in the event, he wasn't capable of doing so, or didn't think it was necessary, or at that moment he just felt too offended to think. He left the rucksacks, the tent, and the sleeping bags where they were, and went out for a walk by himself. For me, it was a liberation. Bruno had been dealt the opposite fate, and was now working with his father as a builder. I hardly ever saw him. They worked high up in the mountains, building refuges in Delpeggi, and slept up there on weekdays. I would encounter him on a Friday or Saturday, not in Grana, but in some cafe bar down in the valley. I had all the time that I wanted now that I had freed myself from the obligation to climb mountains, and while my father scaled the summits, I would head in the opposite direction, searching for someone my own age. It only took 2 or 3 attempts before I was admitted into the company of holidaymakers. I spent the afternoons between the benches of a tennis court and the tables of a cafe bar, hoping that no one would notice that I had no money with which to order anything. I listened to the chat, watched the girls, every so often looked up at the mountains. I recognized the pastures and the minuscule white stains that were plastered huts, the bright green of the larches that gave way to the more somber green of the firs, the right side in sunlight and the reverse in shadow. I knew that I had little enough in common and to share with those young people on their holidays, but I wanted to fight against my inclination towards solitude, to try to be with others for a while and to see what might happen. Later, towards 7, the workmen would arrive at the bar, the bricklayers, the cattle breeders. They would get out of white vans and 4x4s, filthy with mud or lime or sawdust, moving with a lolling gait that they had learned in adolescence, as if, together with the weight of their own bodies, they were always moving another, greater one. They would take up positions at the counter, complaining and cursing, bantering with the waitresses and ordering rounds of drinks. Bruno was with them. I could see that he had developed his muscles and that he liked to show them off by rolling his shirt sleeves high. He owned a collection of caps and a wallet that stuck out from the back pocket of his jeans. This struck me more than anything else, given that for me, earning money was still a distant prospect. He would spend it without even counting, paying for his round with some crumpled banknote or other, imitating the others. But then, at a certain point, with the same distracted air, He would turn towards me from the counter. He knew already that he would meet my gaze. He would give a signal with his chin, and I would reply by raising the fingers of one hand. We looked at each other for a second. That was it. No one noticed. It wasn't repeated during the course of the evening, and I wasn't sure if I was interpreting properly the significance of this greeting. It could mean, I remember you, I miss you. Or it might be, it's only been 2 years, but it seems like a lifetime, doesn't it? Or perhaps, hey, Berio, what are you doing with that crowd? I didn't know what Bruno thought about the clash between our fathers, whether he had any regrets about how things had turned out, or if, seen from his current point of view, that whole story seemed as distant and unreal as it did to me. He didn't have the look of someone who was unhappy at all. On the other hand, it could be that I did. His father was with him in the row of drinkers, amongst those with the more irritating voices and the always empty glasses. He treated Bruno as if he was just another of his drinking companions. I disliked this man, but envied him in one respect. There was nothing perceptible between them. Not a more brusque or solicitous tone of voice, not a gesture of irritation, confidence, or embarrassment. And if you did not know it already, there was nothing to indicate that they were father and son. Not all of the young men of the valley wasted their summer in the bar. After a few days, someone took me to a place on the other side of the river, a wood of wild pines which concealed some huge monoliths, as alien to that landscape as meteorites. The glacier must have pushed them to that point in some far distant past. Then the earth and the leaves and the moss had covered them. Pines had grown around and on top of them. But some of these stones had been brought back to light, cleaned up with wire brushes and even christened with individual names. The youths would challenge each other to find every possible way of climbing them. Without ropes or pegs, they tried and retried approaches from about a meter above ground level, ending up by landing softly in the undergrowth. It was a pleasure to watch the two or three strongest, agile as gymnasts, with hands scoured and white with chalk. They had brought this pastime to the mountain from the city. They were happy enough to teach it to others, and I asked them if I could have a go. After all, I had already climbed with Bruno every kind of rock without knowing anything, since my father had always warned me against adventuring any place where you were dependent on using your hands. And perhaps it was because of this that I decided to become good at it. At sunset, the group expanded to include those who would come to party. Someone would light a fire, someone else would bring something to smoke and something to drink. Then we would sit around, and while the bottle of wine circulated, I would listen to discussions about things that were completely new to me, and that fascinated me every bit as much as the girls sitting on the other side of the fire. I heard about the Californian hippies who had invented modern freeform climbing, bivouacking for entire summers beneath the rock faces of the Yosemite and climbing half-naked, or about the French climbers who trained on the sea cliffs of Provence, wore their hair long, and were accustomed to going up swiftly and light-footed. How when they moved from the sea to the gullies of Mont Blanc, they would humiliate veteran climbers such as my father. Rock climbing was all about the pleasure of being together, about being free to experiment, and for this a 2-meter-high stone on the bank of a river was as good as any at 8,000 meters. It had nothing whatsoever to do with the cult of difficulty, or with the conquest of summits. I listened while the woods became shrouded in darkness. The twisted trunks of the pines, the powerful fragrance of resin, the white monoliths in the light of the fire made it a more welcoming refuge than any of those on Monte Rosa. Later on, someone would begin to try a route with a cigarette between his lips, his sense of balance skewed by drink. Someone else would wander off with a girl at his side. The differences between us counted for less in the woods, perhaps because they were less evident there than elsewhere. They were wealthy young men from Milan, Genoa, and Turin. The less well-off lived in small villas high up in the valley, buildings erected in crazy haste at the foot of the ski slopes. The richest, in the old-style mountain dwellings in exclusive areas, where each stone and every slate had been removed, numbered, and then placed back according to the design of an architect. I happened to go into one of these, accompanying a friend who was fetching drink for the evening. From outside, it looked like an old, timber-built barn. Inside, it revealed itself to be the house of an antiques dealer, or a collector. Virtually an exhibition of fine art books, paintings, furniture, sculpture. And of bottles, as well.
My friend opened a cupboard and we each filled a rucksack.
But won't your father be angry that we're pinching his wine? I asked.
My father, he replied, as if he found the very word ridiculous. We emptied the cellar and ran for the woods. In the meantime, my own father was mortally offended. He'd begun to go to the mountains again, alone, getting up at dawn and leaving before we were awake, and sometimes during his absence I would take a look at his map in order to check on his latest conquests. He had started to explore a part of the valley that we had always avoided, since you could tell from below that there was nothing up there, neither villages, nor water, nor refuges, nor stunning peaks. Only bare slopes that climbed steeply for 2,000 meters, an endless expanse of scree. I think he went there to cool down his disappointment, or to find a landscape that resembled his state of mind. He never again invited me to join him. From his perspective, I had become the one who needed to go to him. If I was the one who'd had the courage to say no, then the onus was on me now to say sorry and please. The time of the glacier came round again, our 2 days of glory in the mid-August holiday, and I saw him preparing the crampons, the pickaxe as severe as a weapon, the water bottle dented by all the knocks it had taken. He seemed to me like the last survivor of one of those alpine expeditions, one of those soldier climbers who went in the '30s to die in droves on the north faces of the Alps, blindly attacking the mountain.
"You need to speak to him," my mother said that morning. "Look how hurt he is."
"But shouldn't he be the one speaking to me?"
"You're capable of doing it. He isn't."
"But capable of doing what?"
"Come on, you know full well. He's only waiting for you to go and ask to come with him."
I did know it, but I did not do it. I went to my room and shortly afterwards watched from the window as my father walked off with a heavy tread, his rucksack stuffed with metal gear. You don't go up the glacier on your own, and I knew that in the evening he would have to resort to a humiliating search. There was always at least one person in his predicament in the refuge. He would go from table to table, he would listen to the discussions for a while, joining the conversation, and would eventually propose joining the group the next morning, despite knowing that nobody was keen to tie a stranger to his rope. At that moment, it seemed to me like the perfect punishment for him. I tasted my own punishment, too, that summer. After much training on the monoliths, I went with 2 youths on my first real free-form climb. One of them was the wine thief, the son of the collector, a Genoese who was amongst the strongest in the group. The other was a friend of his who had started a few months ago, probably just to be with him, since he had not much passion, dedication, or talent for climbing. The rock face was so close to the road that we only had to cross a meadow to reach the point of attack, an overhang jutting out so far that the cattle used it to shelter from the wind and rain. We put our shoes on amongst the cows. Then the Genoese handed me a harness and a locking carabiner, and tied the two of us to the ends of the rope, with himself in the middle. Without further ceremony, he told the other boy to go safely, and we set off. He climbed lightly and flexibly, giving the impression of being weightless, and that his every movement was effortless. He did not need to feel around to find the right point of purchase, but just hit the mark every time. Every so often he unhooked a quick draw from the harness, clipped it onto one of the bolts that marked the way, and would pass the rope through the carabiner. Then he would plunge his hands into the bag of chalk, blow on his fingers, and start to climb again with ease. He looked very elegant. Elegance, grace, lightness, they were all qualities that I was so keen to learn from him. His friend had no such qualities. I could see him close up, climbing, because when the Genoese arrived at the resting place, he shouted down to us to climb up together, leaving just a few meters distance between us. And so, one pull after another, I found myself with his companion directly above my head. I had frequently to stop because my head was right beneath his shoes, at which point I would turn round to look at the world behind my shoulders. The fields yellowed at the end of August, the river sparkling in the sunlight. Cars already miniaturized on the trunk road. The drop did not frighten me. Away from the ground, in the air, I felt good, and the movements of the climb came naturally to my body, requiring concentration but not exceptional muscles or lungs. My companion instead used his arms too much and his feet not enough, He clung close to the rock, so was obliged to seek handholds blind, and he did not refrain from grabbing hold of a bolt when he found no alternative. "You shouldn't do it like that," I told him, making a big mistake. I should have let him do it whichever way he thought best. He looked at me, annoyed, and said, "What do you want? Are you trying to overtake? You're always pressing from down there." From that moment, I had made an enemy. At the resting place, he said to the other one, "Pietro's in a hurry. He thinks it's a race." I didn't say, "Your friend is a cheat who hangs on the bolts." I understood that it would have ended up 2-1. I kept my distance from then on, but the guy would not let it go. Every so often he would make a crack at my expense, and my competitiveness became a running joke for the rest of the day. According to that joke, I was running behind them. I would get to just below them, and they would have to give me a few kicks to get me out from under their feet. The collector's son laughed. When I reached the last resting place, he said, "You're going strong. Do you want to try going first?" "Fine," I answered. In reality, I wanted to get it over with as soon as possible so that they would leave me in peace. I already had my safety harness and all the clips. We didn't have to make any of the usual maneuvers required to exchange places. So I looked up, saw a bolt planted in a fissure, and set off. Finding your way is easy if you have a rope above your head. It's something else entirely when the rope is at your feet. The bolt on which I hooked the first clip was an old ring nail, not one of the steel bolts that glinted along the rock face. I decided to ignore the fact and to advance along the fissure, as I was already making good progress. The thing was, though, that further up the crack began to narrow and soon disappeared altogether. I now had jutting out above me a black, damp roof of rock, and no idea as to how to get over it. "Where do I go?" I shouted. "I can't see from here," the Genoese shouted back. "Are there any bolts there?" No, there were no bolts. I held fast to the last bit of the fissure and leaned out first to one side of it and then the other, to see if I could spot any. I discovered that I had followed a false trail. The line of steel plaquettes ran up at a diagonal a few meters to my right, skirting the overhang and reaching to the top. "I've taken the wrong route," I shouted.
"Oh, really?"
he shouted back in response.
"And what's it like there? Can you get over it?"
"No, it's completely smooth."
"Then you'll have to come back down."
I couldn't see them, but could hear that they were amused. I had never climbed backwards. The fissure that I had come up looked impossible when seen from above. I felt an impulse to hold on even more tightly, and at the same time realized that the rusty iron peg was now some 4 or 5 meters away. One of my legs began to tremble, an uncontrollable trembling that began at the knee and went down to my heel. My foot no longer responded. My hands were sweating, and the rock seemed to be slipping from my grasp.
"I'm falling!" I shouted. "Hold tight!"
Then I went down. A fall of 10 meters is not really anything very serious, but you need to know how to fall. Push yourself away from the rock face and cushion the impact with your feet. No one had taught me how to do this, and I went straight down, flaying myself on the rock in my attempt to get a grip on it. I felt a tightness in my groin when I reached the bottom. Yet this other pain was fortunate. It meant that someone had blocked the rope. Now they were not laughing anymore. Shortly afterwards, we came out on the top of the rock, and it felt strange at that point to find ourselves in the fields again, with a taut line a step from the precipice, the cows grazing, a half-derelict farmstead, a dog barking. I was shaken and in pain. I had blood everywhere, and I suspect that the two friends felt guilty, since one of them asked me, "Are you sure you're all right?"
"Sure."
"Do you want a cigarette?"
"Thanks."
I decided that it would be the last thing we would ever share. I smoked it lying on the grass, looking up at the sky. They said something else to me, but by that stage I wasn't listening anymore. Just as it did every summer, the weather changed at the end of the month. It started raining and getting cold, and it was the mountain itself that prompted in you the desire to go down to the valley to enjoy the warmth of September. My father had left again. My mother began to light the stove. In brief breaks in the weather, I would go into the woods to collect firewood, bending down the dry branches of larches until they broke with a sharp crack. I felt fine up there in Grana. But this time I too was anxious to return to the city. I felt that I had so many things to discover, people to go in search of, and that the near future held important changes in store for me. I lived those last days knowing that they were the last in more than one sense, as if they were memories of the mountain that were already in the past. I liked the fact that we were like this, my mother and I alone together again, the fire crackling in the kitchen, the cold of the early morning, the hours spent reading and wandering in the woods. There were no rocks to climb in Grana, but I discovered that I could train well enough by climbing the walls of derelict houses. I would go up and come down the corners methodically, avoiding the easiest handholds and trying to support myself using only the cracks and the tips of my fingers. Then I would cross from one corner to another and back. In this way, I must have climbed every derelict building in the village. One Sunday, the sky was clear again. We were having breakfast when there was a knock at the door. It was Bruno. He was standing there on the balcony, smiling.
"Hey, Berio," he said. "Coming into the mountains?"
Without any preamble, he explained to me that his uncle had had the idea of acquiring some goats that summer. He would leave them to graze freely on the mountain near the Alpeggio, so that he needed to do nothing except check on them through binoculars in the evening, making sure that they were all there and had not strayed from where he could keep an eye on them. The problem was that during their first few nights up there, it had snowed, and now his uncle couldn't find them. Chances were that they had sought shelter in some hole or other, or run off behind a passing herd of ibexes. Bruno spoke of it as if it was just one more example of his uncle's harebrained schemes. He owned a motorbike now, an old rusted one without number plates, and with this we took the road leading up to the farmstead, dodging the lowest branches of the larches and getting covered in mud going through puddles. I liked gripping his back, riding pillion, and sensed no embarrassment on his part. On the other side of his uncle's meadows, we took a straight track at a good speed. In this patchy and stony grass, the goat's droppings were everywhere. Following them, we climbed up a bank of rhododendrons and a fallen rock where a nearly dry river ran. Then the snow began. Up to that moment, I had known only one of the mountain seasons, a short-lived summer that resembled spring at the beginning of July and autumn at the end of August. About winter, I knew next to nothing. Bruno and I used to speak about it often enough as children, when my return to the city was approaching and I became melancholy and imagined what it would be like to live up there with him all year round.
"But you don't know what it's like up here in the winter," he would say. "There's nothing but snow."
"I'd love to see it," I would reply. And now here it was. This wasn't the frozen snow of the gorges at 3,000 meters. It was fresh, soft snow that got into your shoes and soaked your feet, and it was strange to lift them and to see, compressed in your footprint, the wild flowers of August. The snow barely reached to my ankles, but it was deep enough to have covered all traces of the track. It covered the bushes, the holes, and stones, so that every step was a potential trap, and with my lack of experience walking on such snow, I could only follow Bruno by stepping into his footprints. As when we were younger, I could not understand by what memory or instinct he was guided. I just followed. We reached the ridge that overlooked the other side, and as soon as the wind turned, it carried to us the sound of bells. The goats had taken shelter lower down, beneath the first rocks. Reaching them was simple enough. They were huddling in groups of three or four, the mothers with their kids around them, in clearings in the snow. Counting them, Bruno saw that there was not a single one missing. They were less obedient than cattle, some feral after a summer spent on the mountain, and climbing back over our own tracks, he had to shout to keep them together, throwing snowballs at any that strayed, and cursing his uncle and his brilliant ideas. Eventually, we reached the crest again, and went down onto the snow in unruly and noisy procession. It must have been midday by the time we had the grass beneath our feet. Suddenly it was summer again, the goats, famished, scattered over the meadow. For our part, we began to rush down, not because we were in any particular hurry, but because this was the only way we knew of being in the mountains, and the descent had always exhilarated us. When we reached the motorbike, Bruno said,
"I saw you while you were rock climbing. You're good."
I started this summer.
And do you like it?
A lot.
As much as the river game? I laughed.
No, I said, not that much.
This summer I've built a wall.
Where?
Up in the mountains, in a stable. It was falling down, and we had to rebuild it completely. The problem was, there was no road, and I went back and forth on the bike. We had to work like in the old times, spade, bucket, and pickaxe.
And do you enjoy it?
Yes, he said, after mulling it over a bit. The work? Yes. It's difficult to build a wall in that way.
There was something else that he didn't like, but he didn't tell me what, and I didn't ask him. I didn't ask him how he was getting on with his father, or how much money he was earning, or if he had a girlfriend, or any plans for the future, or about what he thought of what had happened between us. Nor did he ask me anything. He didn't ask how I was, or how my parents were, and I didn't reply. My mother's well, my father's still fucked off with me. That things had changed a bit that summer. I thought that I had found some friends, but I was mistaken. I had kissed two girls in one evening. Instead, I just told him that I would go back to Grana on foot.
Are you sure?
Yes. I'm leaving tomorrow, and I feel like walking.
Right. Be seeing you then.
It was my end-of-summer ritual, a last wander around alone to say goodbye to the mountains. I watched as Bruno straddled the motorcycle and started it after a few attempts, with a puff of black smoke from the exhaust. He had a certain style as a motorcyclist. He raised a hand in farewell and revved the engine. I returned his wave, even though he was no longer looking at me. I had no way of knowing it then, but we would not meet up again for a very long time. The next year I turned 17 and would only return to Grana for a few days, and would then stop going there altogether. The future would take me away from this mountain of my childhood. It was a sad, a beautiful, and an inevitable fact that I had already become fully aware of. When Bruno and his motorcycle disappeared into the wood, I turned towards the slope we had come down, staying there a while before leaving, looking at the long line of our tracks in the snow.
2. The House of Reconciliation. 5. My father died when he was 62 and I was 31. It was only at his funeral that I realized I was the same age now as he'd been when I was born, but my 31 years had little enough in common with his. I had not married, I had not gone to work in a factory, I had not fathered a son, and my life seemed to me to be only partly that of a grown man, and partly still like that of an adolescent. I lived alone in a studio flat, a luxury which I struggled to afford. I would like to have made a living as a documentary filmmaker, but to pay the rent I accepted work of every kind. I too had emigrated, having inherited from my parents the idea that at a key point in one's youth it was necessary to leave the place where you'd been born and raised in order to go and develop elsewhere. I had, at 23 and fresh out of military service, left Milan to join a girlfriend in Turin. My relationship with the girl did not last, but my relationship with the city did. Between its ancient rivers and in its arcade cafes, I'd felt immediately at home. I was reading Hemingway and wandered around penniless, trying to keep myself open to new encounters, to offers of work, and to every possibility, with the mountains as the background to my movable feast. Even if I had never gone back there, to glimpse sight of them on my horizon every time I left the apartment seemed like a blessing. And so it was that 120 kilometers of rice fields now divided me from my father. It was no distance, but to cover it you had to want to do so. A couple of years previously, I had given him one last great disappointment by abandoning my university studies. I had always excelled at maths, and he had always foreseen for me a future similar to his own. My father told me that I was throwing my life away. I replied that he had thrown his away before me. We didn't speak for an entire year after that, during which time I was coming and going between home and my military barracks, returning from leave with scarcely a word in parting. It was better for both of us that I should follow my own path, invent a life different from his in some other place, and once that distance was established, neither of us was inclined to close it. With my mother it was different. Since I was not one to speak much on the phone, she took it upon herself to write me letters. She discovered soon enough that I would reply.
I liked to sit down at the table of an evening, take pen and paper, and tell her what was happening with me. It was by letter that I told her of my decision to enroll in a film school. It was there that I made my first friends in Turin. I was fascinated by documentary film and felt that I had a vocation for observing and listening. So it was good to get her reassurance. Yes, you've always been good at that. I knew that it would take a long time to turn it into a profession, but she encouraged me from the outset. For years she would send me money, and I would send her in return everything that I was making. Portraits of people and places, explorations of the city. Short films that nobody ever saw, but of which I was proud. I liked the life that was taking shape around me. This is what I would tell her when she asked if I was happy. I avoided answering her other questions, about the relationships with girlfriends, which never lasted more than a few months, since as soon as they became serious, I would extricate myself from them. "And you?" I would write. "I'm fine," my mother would answer. "But your dad is working too hard, and it's damaging his health." She would tell me more about him than about herself. The factory was in financial crisis, and my father, after a 30-year career, was redoubling his efforts instead of slowing down and biding his time before retirement. He was spending a lot of time in the car alone, driving hundreds of kilometers between one plant and another, returning home exhausted and collapsing into bed immediately after supper. His sleep was short-lived. At night he would get up and go back to work, unable to rest because of his worries, which, according to my mother, were not only about the factory. "He's always been anxious, but now it's becoming an illness." He was anxious about his work, anxious about approaching old age, anxious because my mother had flu. And he was anxious about me as well. He would be jolted awake with the thought that I was unwell. So he would ask her to phone me, even if it meant getting me out of bed. She was unable to convince him to wait a few hours, but tried to calm him, to get him back to sleep, to slow him down. It was not as if his own body hadn't been giving him signs that he should do so, but he only knew how to live this way, with everything breathing down his neck. Imploring him to calm down was like constraining him to go up a mountain more slowly, to avoid getting into a race with anyone, to enjoy the health-giving properties of the air. He was only partly the man that I knew, and partly another, the one that I was discovering through my mother's letters. I was intrigued by this other side to him. It brought to mind a certain fragility that I had only glimpsed before, certain moments of confusion which he would immediately attempt to conceal. When I would lean out over a rock and he would instinctively make a grab for my trouser belt. When I was sick on the glacier and he would be more worried about it than I was myself. It occurred to me that perhaps this other father had always been there at my side, and that I had failed to notice him, however difficult the first one was. And I began to think that in the future I should, or could, make an attempt to build bridges with him. Then that future vanished in an instant, together with the possibilities it contained. One March evening in 2004, my mother called to tell me that my father had suffered a heart attack on the motorway. They had found him in a lay-by. He had not caused an accident. In fact, he had managed to do everything correctly. He had stopped at the side of the road and put on the hazard lights, as if he had a flat tire or had run out of petrol. Instead, it was his heart that had completely failed on him. Too many miles on the clock, too little maintenance. My father must have felt an acute pain in his chest and had enough time to realize what was happening. In the lay-by, he had turned off the engine, but he hadn't even unbuckled his seatbelt. He had stayed sitting there, and that's how they found him, like a racing driver who had retired from the race. The most ironic way for someone like him to go, with his hands still on the wheel, being overtaken by everyone else. That spring, I went back to Milan for a few weeks to be with my mother. Apart from the practicalities that needed to be dealt with, I felt the need to be with her for a while. After the turbulent days of the funeral and the calm that followed, we discovered, to my surprise, that my father had thought thoroughly about his own death. In his desk drawer, there was a list of instructions, attached to which were details of his bank accounts and everything else that was required for us to inherit his assets. Since we were the only inheritors, he had not been obliged by Italian law to make a formal will. But on the same piece of paper on which he had specified that he had left to my mother his half of the apartment in Milan, for me there was the phrase, "I would like Pietro to have," followed mysteriously by, "the property in Grana." No last words,
not a line of farewell or explanation. It was all cold and practical and legalistic. About this inheritance, my mother knew next to nothing. There is a tendency to assume that one's parents share everything that crosses their minds, especially as they get older. But I was discovering in those days that after my departure they had led more or less separate lives. He worked and was always traveling. Having retired from her own job, she was doing voluntary work as a nurse in a clinic for immigrants, helping with prenatal classes, and spent most of her other time with friends rather than with my father. She knew only that he had acquired, the previous year, and for not much money, a small piece of land in the mountains. He had not sought her permission to spend the money, or even invited her to see the place. It was a long time since they had gone out walking together, and she had not objected, considering it to be some altogether private concern. Amongst my father's papers, I found the contract of the purchase and the land registry document, neither of which enlightened me much further. I had inherited an agricultural building, 4 meters by 7, at the center of an irregular plot of land. The map was too small to work out where this place was, and too different from the ones I was used to. It did not show the altitude or the paths, only the property, and looking at it told you nothing about whether it was surrounded by woods, fields, or by anything else for that matter. My mother said, "Bruno will know where it is." Bruno? They were always going off together. I didn't know that they'd even seen each other again. Of course, we both saw him again. It's quite difficult not to meet up in a place like Grana, wouldn't you say? What's he doing now? I asked, though what I really wanted to ask was, how is he? Does he remember me? During all these years, had he thought about me as much as I thought about him? But I had learned by now to ask questions in the adult way, asking one thing in order to find out about another. He's a bricklayer. So he never moved away? Bruno? And where do you think he would go? Things have not changed much in Grana, you'll see. I did not know whether to believe her, since I had certainly changed a lot in the meantime. As an adult, a place that you loved as a young boy might appear entirely different to you and turn out to be a disappointment. Or it might remind you of what you once were but no longer are, becoming a cause for great sadness. I wasn't that keen to find out how it would be. But there was this property that I had been left, and curiosity got the better of me. I went there at the end of April, alone in my father's car. It was evening, and climbing up the valley, I could only see the areas illuminated by the lights. Even so, I noticed several changes. The points at which the road had been improved and widened, the protective netting over the escarpments, the piles of felled tree trunks. Someone had started to build little villas in a Tyrolese style, while someone else had started to extract sand and gravel from the river, which was shored up now between cement banks, where it had once flowed between stones and trees. The second homes in darkness, the hotels closed out of season or shut for good, the immobile bulldozers and the excavators with their arms stuck in the ground, gave the landscape an air of industrial decline, like those building sites left semi-abandoned due to bankruptcy. Then just as I was letting myself feel depressed by these discoveries, something called out for my attention, and I leaned over towards the windscreen to look up. In the night sky, some white shapes emitted a kind of aura. It took me a moment to realize that they were not clouds. They were mountains still covered in snow. I should have expected it in April. But in the city, the spring was already advanced, and I was no longer accustomed to the fact that to go up high is to go back a season. The snow up there consoled me for the squalor in the valley. Then I realized that I had just repeated one of my father's typical gestures. How many times had I seen him while driving lean forwards and look up at the sky? To check the state of the weather, or to study the side of a mountain, or just to admire its outline as we passed it. He placed his hands together high up on the steering wheel and rested his temple on them. I repeated the gesture, aware this time of the similarity, imagining myself as my father at 40, having just turned into the valley with my wife sitting beside me and my son on the back seat, looking for a good place for the three of us. I imagined my son sleeping. My wife was pointing out villages and particular houses, and I was pretending to be listening. But then, as soon as she was looking the other way, I would lean forward and look up, heeding the powerful call of the peaks. The more towering and menacing they looked, the more I liked them. The snow up there was most promising. Yes, perhaps on that particular mountain there would be a good place for us. The little road that climbed up to Grana had been asphalted, but as for the rest, my mother was right. It seemed as if nothing had changed at all. The ruined buildings were still there, and so too were the stables, the haylofts, the piles of manure. I left the car in the usual place and went into the village on foot in the dark, letting myself be guided by the sound of the drinking fountain, finding my way to the stairs and the door of the house, its big iron key still in the lock. Once inside, I was greeted by the old smell of smoke and damp. In the kitchen, I opened the stove door and found a small pile of still faintly glowing embers. I put in some of the wood that had been stacked nearby and blew until the fire was kindled again. Even my father's concoctions were still in their usual place. He would usually bring a large bottle of white grappa and then flavor it in smaller bottles with the berries, pine cones, and herbs that he collected in the mountains. I chose a jar at random and poured some into a glass to warm myself up. It was very bitter, flavored with gentian maybe, and I sat with it next to the stove and rolled a cigarette. Smoking and looking around me in the old kitchen, I waited for the memories to come. My mother had done a good job there over the course of 20 years. Everywhere I looked, I could detect her touch, that of a woman with clear ideas about how to make a house homely. She had always liked copper pans and wooden spoons, and never liked curtains that stopped you from seeing outside. On the ledge of her favorite window, she had placed a bunch of dried flowers in a pitcher, together with the small radio that she listened to all day, and a photo in which Bruno and I were sitting back to back on a larch stump, probably at his uncle's farmstead, with our arms folded, looking like real tough guys. I could not remember who had taken it or when, but we were wearing the same clothes and adopting the same ridiculous pose. Anyone who saw it would have taken it for a portrait of two brothers. I also thought that it was a good photo. I finished the cigarette and threw the butt into the stove. I picked up the empty glass and got up to refill it, and it was then that I saw my father's map, still thumbtacked to the wall, though it looked quite different now from how I remembered it. I went closer to look at it in detail. I saw at once that it had changed from being what it was before, a map of the valley's trails, and that it had become something else altogether, something resembling a novel. Or better still, perhaps, a biography. After 20 years, there was not a summit, an arpeggio, a refuge that my father's felt-tip pen had not reached. And this network of itineraries was so dense as to render the map illegible to anyone else. And now there was not just black ink there. Sometimes it had been marked with red lines, at other times with green. Occasionally the black, red, and green were used together, though most frequently it was the black ink alone that had been used to record the longest excursions. There must have been a key to this code, and I lingered there trying to figure out what it was. After I'd thought about it for a while, it began to resemble one of those riddles that my father used to ask me when I was a child. I went to fill my glass and returned to scrutinize the map. If it had been a cryptographic problem like those I had studied at university, I would have begun by looking for the most recurrent elements, and for the least frequent. Most frequent were the single black lines. The least frequent, those lines where the three colors had been used together. It was the three colors that gave me the key, because I remembered well the time that the three of us, myself, my father, and Bruno, had got stuck on the glacier together. The red line and the green line ended at precisely this point, but the black one continued. From this, I understood that my father had completed the rest of the climb alone on another occasion. The black, of course, was him. The red accompanied him up to our 4,000ers, so could only be me. The green, by a simple process of elimination, was Bruno. My mother had told me that they'd gone walking together. I saw that there were many routes of black and green combined, perhaps even more than of black and red, and I felt a pang of jealousy. But I also felt pleased that during all those years my father had not just gone into the mountains alone. The thought occurred to me that, in some complicated way, this map that was pinned to the wall might contain a message for me. Later, I went into my old room, but it was too cold to sleep there. I took the mattress from the bed, carried it to the kitchen, and put the sleeping bag on top of it. I kept the grappa and tobacco within reach. Before turning off the light, I stoked up the fire in the stove, and lay there in the dark, listening to the sound of it burning for a long while, without falling asleep. Bruno came to get me early the next morning. He was a man I no longer knew, but somewhere inside of him was the boy I knew so well. "Thanks for the fire," I said.
"Don't mention it," he said.
He shook my hand on the porch and uttered one of those conventional phrases that I had become accustomed to in the past 2 months, and to which I no longer paid attention. Such phrases would have been of no use between friends, but who could say what Bruno and I were to each other now? His clasp, as we shook hands, seemed more sincere, his right hand dry and coarse, calloused, and with something else about it that was strange and that I didn't understand at first. He sensed my unease and raised it to show me. It was a builder's hand, with the ends of its index and middle fingers missing.
"Have you seen?" he said. "I was messing around with my father's rifle. I wanted to shoot a fox, and boom, I blew off parts of my own fingers."
"Did it burst in your hands?"
"Not exactly. Faulty trigger."
"Ouch," I said. "That must have hurt." Bruno shrugged his shoulders as if to say that there were worse things in life. He looked at my chin and asked, "Don't you ever shave?" "I've had this beard for 10 years, I replied, stroking it. "I tried to let mine grow once, but I had a girlfriend, you know how it is."
"She didn't like your beard?"
"That's right. On you it looks good. You look like your father." He smiled as he said this. Since we were trying to break the ice, I tried to pay no attention to the phrase and returned his smile, then closed the door and went with him. The sky in the deep valley was low and overcast with spring clouds. It looked as if it had just stopped raining and that it could start again at any moment. Even the smoke from the chimneys was struggling to rise. It slipped down the wet roofs and curled up in the guttering. Leaving the village in that cold light, I rediscovered every shack, every henhouse, every woodshed, as if no one had touched anything since I'd left. The things that had been damaged I saw soon after, beyond the last house. Down below, the bed of the river was at least twice as wide as I remembered it. It looked as if a gigantic plow had recently turned it over. It flowed between wide stony areas that gave it an anemic look, even in this season of thaw.
"Have you seen?" Bruno said.
"What happened?"
"The flood of 2000, don't you remember? So much water came down that we had to be taken out by helicopter."
There was a digger working down there. Where was I in the year 2000? So far away in both body and spirit that I hadn't even been aware of the flooding in Grana. The river was still littered with tree trunks, beams, pieces of cement, wreckage of every kind dragged down from the mountain. On the bends, the eroded banks exposed the roots of trees growing in search of soil that was no longer there. I felt very sorry for our poor little river. A bit higher up, near the mill, I noticed something in the water that raised my spirits, a large white stone in the shape of a wheel.
"So was that also brought down by the water?" I asked.
"Oh, no," said Bruno. "I threw that one down before the flood."
"When?"
"I did it to celebrate my 18th birthday."
"So how did you manage it?"
"With a car jack." It made me smile. I imagined Bruno entering the mill with the jack, and the millstone coming out through the door and starting to roll down. I would have loved to have been there.
"Was it good?" I asked.
"It was amazing."
Bruno smiled too. Then we headed off in search of my property.
We climbed a good deal slower than we used to, since I was not in shape at all and had ended up drinking too much the previous evening. Going up the valley devastated by the flood, where the meadows along the riverbank were reduced to sand and stones, Bruno had to turn around frequently, show his astonishment that I was so far behind, then stop and wait. Between one bout of coughing and another, I said,
"Go ahead if you want. I'll catch you up."
"No, no," he said, as if he had set himself a specific task and had a duty to complete it. Not even his uncle's farmstead looked right. When we passed by it, I saw that the roof of one of the huts had caved in, pushing out the wall on which the beams rested. It looked as if a heavy fall of snow would have been enough to finish it off altogether. The bath had been left to rust outside of the stable, and the doors were off their hinges and thrown jumbled against a wall. Just as in the prophecy made by Luigi Guglielmina, the larch saplings were springing up everywhere in the pastures. Who knows how long it had taken them, and what had happened to his uncle? I would have liked to ask Bruno, but he did not stop, so we passed the farmstead and kept going without a word between us. Beyond the cabins, the flood had done the worst damage. Up above, where once the cows used to climb at the height of the season, the rain had brought down an entire piece of the mountain. The landslide had dragged down with it trees and rocks, a mess of unstable material which even after 4 years gave way beneath our feet. Bruno continued in silence. He led the way with his boots sinking in the mud, jumping from one rock to another, concentrating on keeping his balance while walking across fallen tree trunks, and he did not turn round. I had to run to keep behind him until we were beyond the landslide. The forest welcomed us again, and he finally recovered his speech. "Few people used to come this way, even before," he said. "Now that the path is no longer here, I'm probably the only one who does."
"Do you come here much?"
"Sure, in the evening."
"In the evening?"
"When I fancy a walk after work. I take the head torch with me in case it gets dark."
"Some people go to the bar."
"I've been to the bar. Enough bars already. The woods are better."
Then I asked the forbidden question, the one that could never be uttered while walking with my father.
"Is it much further?"
"No, no. It's just that soon we'll find snow." I had already noticed it in the shadow of the rocks, old snow that had been rained on and would soon turn into slush. But further up, when I lifted my head, I saw that it stained the scree and filled broad expanses of the gorges of Greenan. On the whole of the north side, it was still winter. The snow followed the shape of the mountain like a film negative, with the black of the rocks warming in the sun and the white of the snow surviving in the areas of shadow. I was thinking about this when we reached the lake. Just as it had the first time, the lake revealed itself suddenly.
"Do you remember this place?" asked Bruno.
"Of course."
"It's not like in the summer, eh?"
"No." Our lake in April was still covered by a layer of ice, by an opaque white veined with thin blue cracks, like those that form in porcelain. There was no regular geometrical aspect to this crackalura, or any comprehensible lines of fracture. Here and there slabs of ice had been raised by the force of the water, and along the banks in sunlight you could see the first darker tones, the beginning of summer. And yet, casting our eyes around the basin, it seemed as if we were seeing two seasons at once. On this side was the scree, the bursts of juniper and rhododendron. On the other, the woods and snow. Over there, the wake of an avalanche came down along the Greenon and ended up in the lake. Bruno headed straight for it. Leaving the shore, we began to climb up the snow slope, a frozen crust that almost always held firm beneath our feet, but that sometimes suddenly gave way. When it did so, we would sink thigh-deep in snow. Every false step cost us a laborious extraction, and it was only after half an hour of such halting progress that Bruno allowed us to rest. He found a stone wall that emerged from the snow, climbed on top of it, and cleaned off his boots by knocking them together. I sat down without caring about my sodden feet. I had an overwhelming desire to get back in front of the stove, to eat, and to sleep.
"Here we are," he said.
"Where?"
"What do you mean, where?"
"At your place." It was only then that I looked around. Although the snow altered the shape of everything, I could see that where we were standing, the slope formed a kind of wooded terrace. A wall of flat, high, and unusually white rock came down onto this plateau, facing the lake. From the snow emerged the remains of three dry stone walls, one of which I was sitting on, built from the same white rock. Two short walls and a longer one in front, 4 meters by 7, just as the land registry map had specified. The fourth wall, which supported the other three, was the rock face itself that had provided the material for their construction. Of the collapsed roof there was no trace, but inside the ruin, in the middle of the snow, a small Swiss pine had begun to grow, having found its way amongst the rubble, and reached up to the height of the walls. So there it was, my inheritance. A rock face, snow, a pile of shaped stones, a pine tree.
When we first chanced across this place, it was September, Bruno said.